And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And today I'm joined by memoirist Beth Kephart. She's been on the show before with a couple of her memoirs, and she now has a new book called Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir, published by Gotham Books. And it's one of the best books I've read on writing memoir, and it's wonderful to have her on, especially since she's written quite a few memoirs and can speak with authority on memoir. Hi, Beth.
Thank you for that introduction, and it's so nice to be back with you. I love talking to you.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you wrote this book. Will you talk a little bit about it and how it came about?
Well, I had written 5 memoirs, as you know, and then I'd written another book called Flow, which was a memoir, so to speak, of a river story told in her voice. And I began to teach at the University of Pennsylvania, and of course I've done workshops all over the country. And I began to think about how to encapsulate. So many people kept asking me, how do you write a memoir? And I thought, how do I put this into a book? How do I give the gift of what I've learned back? There are consequences to writing memoir. I've learned them. You would never write a perfect memoir. I've learned from writing my own what not to do. And I learned so much from my incredible students at Penn. So I wanted to put in a single place what I've learned, what I believe, what my students have taught me, some of their work, and also really the best list of memoirs that I could come up with to share with people. You can't write memoir unless you read memoir. So in the back of the book, there's a pretty extensive 75 or so memoirs that are described. And the final reason, Barbara, and maybe it was the first, I don't know, it's in there all the way through, is that memoir as a form has been so denigrated and pummeled and bruised by those who haven't quite executed the form in the right way, those who have published autobiography but called it memoir, and those who have published fiction and called it memoir. And I believe in this form if it's done well, and I wanted to perhaps herald a renaissance of the form if we do it with respect. So that's the answer to the question. Long-winded, but that's the answer.
Long-winded is fine on this show. I love long-winded, actually. I'm curious, you know, backing up just a bit, if you could talk about how you found your way to the form, and if fiction was ever a contender, or poetry, or some other form, or if you came directly to this.
Well, that's a great question. I came to memoir as almost a mother. I was reading Natalie Kutz. Her memoir, Road Song, was the first memoir proper that I'd read, and I just absolutely fell in love with the form. But I'd been writing poetry since I was 9. I'd published at least 36 short stories. I continue to publish and write both poetry and fiction. So there's, I believe in all of the forms, and I believe that we can learn from the form. You know, as I write memoir, I'm thinking about fiction and poetry, all of it. But I only feel versed deeply enough in memoir to write a book like this about craft. Memoir is so complex, it's so challenging, there's just so much about it that we can do wrong, as I said, this is the field where I thought I could write this kind of book.
When you were talking a little bit ago about how the book came about, you talked about the consequences of memoir. Oh. And I wonder if you could say more in terms of what you found or what your experience has been.
I feel, you know, chastened by this form. I have written 5 memoirs, every single one out of love toward love. There was never a desire to report on somebody, to judge someone, to negatively characterize someone. But what I didn't learn, what I didn't know soon enough, is that you freeze people in time across the memoirs, except for perhaps the last one. You're freezing people in time. And it's an unintentional fallout. And you have to really be able to think about 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20. Is this how we want this person to be, or any of the people, myself included, that's in the books, is this how we want them held in the public eye for all that time? And this is something that many people don't think about as they sit down to write these books or these essays. It's just not there when you're at least when I was thinking about it.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Beth Kephart. Her book is Handling the Truth. I wonder if you would read from the beginning of the book, just the very first page, and even maybe read the entire. I'm looking at page 3.
Okay, let me find
prefatory,
page 3.
Prefatory, and I think the chapter is pretty short, or read half of it, or
okay.
Wherever you find
it. I love this chapter.
Yeah, I do too.
And it also illustrates something later in the book, which is that memoir doesn't always have to be written in first person. This is the only place where I approach this work in second person, but I feel it's important to look at all the different voices that you can use. So it begins like this. Maybe the audacity of it thrills you. Maybe it's always been like this, you out on the edge with your Verity serums, your odd-sized heart, your wet eyes urging. Maybe this is what you are good for after all, or good at, though there, you've done it again, wanted proof, suggested the possibility. You teach memoir. You negotiate truth. Goodness doesn't matter here. Bearing witness does. Memoir is a strut and a confession, a whisper in the ear, a scream. Memoir performs, then seeds. It is the work of thieves. It is a seduction and a sleight of hand, and the world won't rise above it, or you won't. You and the Victorian manse at the edge of the Ivy League campus, where you arrive early and sit in the attitude of prayer. You who know something not just of the toil, but also of the psychic cost, the pummeling doubt, the lacerating regrets that live in the aftermath of public confession. You have written memoir in search of the lessons children teach, and in confusion over the entanglements of friendship. You have written in despair regarding the sensational impossibility of knowing another, in defense of the imperiled imagination, and in throes of the loathsome sink toward middle age. You have written quiet, and expected quiet, and yet a terrible noise has hurried in, a churlish self-recrimination that cluttered the early hours when clear-minded non-memoirists slept. You have learned from all that. You have decided memoir is and will still be, but cautions must be taken. And I'll stop there.
Hmm. You know, one of the reasons I love your book is because, not just for the information and really the good solid stuff you talk about in terms of how to write a memoir, but your voice. And this is proof of why everybody should, if not work on poetry, at least read it, because it's all there. You know, your book is lovely and wonderful to read as well as to learn from. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious, first person, third person, even second person is interesting and reminds me of a couple of weeks ago at the West Hollywood Book Fair, James Brown, the memoirist, was talking about second person. And in his book, The Los Angeles Diaries, the very last chapter is written in second person. And I love that. And I wonder if you could talk more about choosing how you write your book and whether you can combine, voices, tenses, all that.
Bell Hooks does it. She does first, second, third in a single book. I love Mark Richard's House of Prayer number 2, a memoir written entirely in second person. And there are very specific reasons for that. He had a very unusual childhood. The second person allows him to get some distance on it. It allows him to filter in a really magical way. We, in our class, read House of Prayer number 2, I think, maybe two years ago. I always choose different ones because I love so many books. And I had the class choose any section that they wanted to and try to write that passage in first person and to see what would happen. And it completely flattened the story by trying to tell what he does in second and first. So there are so many decisions you have to make. It seems obvious to write a memoir in first person, but you don't have to. It seems, you think about past and present tense. Well, you, like Mary Carr, can combine the two, or like Elizabeth Gilbert, you don't have to set out and just say, I'm doing this in past tense, or I'm doing this in present tense. There are so many tools available to the memoirist, and perhaps that's why I love the form. I've been asked, I could teach young adult literature, for example, but I continue, for many reasons, to teach memoir, because, as you said, look at Michael Ondaatje and Running in the Family, there's reporting on a country in there, there's poetry in there, there's the artifact of geography and map, you know, the map world of Sri Lanka, Ceylon, and so I love how memoir exploded, you know, a Terry Tempest Williams. You have all of these tools in your possession, and you can create a magnificent work of art if you think about it not simply as, I am going to tell you what happened to me in my life.
Well, you know, also getting back to something from just a few minutes ago, your list in the back of the book, I notice a few very famous memoirs are not on your list. And I don't need to mention the names. But, you know, you can all buy the book and see what's left off. But, it's...
What an astute reader.
It's curious. I find it curious because a couple of the very famous memoirs that you've left off the list are more novelistic, I think, in certain ways. And I don't know if that's why you left them off, or if you could just say more about...
Why? What was the screening process?
Yeah.
I would say for every 10 to 15 memoirs I read, one would end up in the back of the book. There are many filters for me. There is the... there are so many. Right in the front of the book, I talk about what memoir is not. And let me find that and go through. Mm-hmm. And that will probably be a pretty good guide to readers as to what was my thinking. But yes, if something was clearly fictionalized, by that I mean if there's a ton of dialogue from when someone was 3, 4, 5 years old, and you know which books I'm referring to there, if a book was written to sensationalize and not to understand, it's not there. If a book is pure autobiography, which is, again, to say, this just happened to me, I'm not really thinking about the other readers in the room. I'm thinking about just myself. I'm just going to tell you what happened to me. I'm not going to search for meaning in this. I'm not going to try to figure out how my story might bridge to your story. Then I took that off, too. In the beginning, memoir is not... It's not autobiography, and by that I mean a chronological, thematically tone-deaf recitation of everything remembered. It's not a diary. There are some wonderful diaries, but this is not, memoir is not diary. It's not exhibitionism for exhibitionism's sake. Some very famous memoirs fall into that category, and I am not a fan of retaliatory memoirs. It's not a lecture, it's not a lesson, it's not a self-administered therapy session, it's not an exercise in self-glorification, another thing that kept some books off my list. And it's not fiction. It's not, unfortunately, what Nasdij and James Frye and so many tried to push toward the form.
So, okay, so taking off celebrity memoirs, taking those away, what struck me is, okay, it's not self-glorification, they're not written to sensationalize, and a memoir should not be exhibitionism. Those are sort of, I wonder if you could say more, because those are, can be kind of subtle, too, you know.
Yes, they can. I don't leave my readers just with the knots. I start with that. But let me read, then, the first paragraph of what memoir is from the book. And here we go. If you want to write memoir, you need to set caterwauling narcissism to the side. You need to soften your stance. You need to work through the explosives, anger, aggrandizement, injustice, misfortune, despair, fumes toward mercy. Real memoirists, literary memoirists, don't justify behaviors, decisions, moods. They don't ladder themselves up high, high, high so as to look down upon the rest of us. Real memoirists open themselves to self-discovery and in the process make themselves vulnerable, not just to the world, but also to themselves. They yearn and they are yearned with. They declare a want to know. They seek out loud. They quest. They lessen the distance. They lean toward. So many people who have something extraordinary happen to them, and I will add, who create a situation so that something extraordinary and therefore reportable happens to them, are not thinking about those broader universal questions that make memoir so special. We empathize as readers, but we also need to connect. And it doesn't matter who you are. Diane Keaton and Patti Smith are two incredible celebrities and memoirists because they deal at the real human level of what it was like in Patti Smith's friend case to have a friend like Robert Mapplethorpe, what it was like to live that life. But she doesn't isolate herself. She doesn't separate herself. Diane Keaton does an extraordinary thing in her memoir. She wants to understand choices that she's made and her mother has made, and she filters the stories she tells through that screen. And so they're thinking more broadly about humankind. And they're not just saying, hey, look at me, it was bad, it was rich, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger than that. It has to be. If it's not, we are all going to be, we memoirists are all going to suffer from the general broader view that, oh, it's just another All About Me book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Patti Smith's Just Kids. I just started listening to it just before I walked in the show because I forget who sort of was, rearranged their thinking about the book, but at first it's like...
Oh, yes, I saw that. Uh-huh.
Yeah, maybe it was Stephen King or somebody yeah. recently is like, Patti Smith, and then they listened to it and went, okay.
I saw that. Yeah. I don't remember where I saw that, but I was so happy that he showed the process of his thinking, that he said, oh, it's a celebrity memoir, but mm-hmm. then he reaches across, he gives it a chance, and there it is. You know, there's some incredibly intelligent celebrities out there. they're celebrities for a reason. I find that when the so-called celebrity writes their own book, they do a lot more grappling. You know, they're trying mm-hmm. to understand what it all meant.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Beth Kephart. Her book is Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir, and it's published by Gotham. And I love the bright orangey-red cover, actually. I think it's great.
When I go around with this book, it's like, I may be dull-looking, but my book isn't.
Well, you're hardly dull-looking, but it's easy to find on the shelf, and I appreciate that. Story arc, structure. Now, okay, so, some memoirs that people tell me that they love, they say, well, it's like a novel. It has a story arc, it has a dramatic, through line. What do you think about all that? I mean, say a little more about that, because there are also memoirs that are written very, they have strange structures. Like, I'm thinking of Lying by Lauren Slater, or there's a few, that just have really different structures and that seem to work.
Lauren Slater is such an interesting case. She was one of my early favorites, but then as her memoirs continued to come out, they began to contradict each other until the final one. And so that was interesting because she's a gorgeous, gorgeous writer. Well, structure. I am not a fan, although I've participated in it in a way sometimes, of the purely chronological retelling of a story, of a life story. I think that you have the responsibility as a memoirist to carefully structure your story, your memoir, around the themes that you're working toward. What are the questions you are trying to answer? in your book. And that's going to dictate themes, and that's going to dictate tone and mood and your voice, and it's going to break things open for you. The real suspense in reading memoir, I believe, should be not what happened, because often in a prologue or a preface, or because we've read the press, we already know that somebody got down the mountain, or whatever else happened. But how are the overriding questions of this memoir going to be answered? How is this writer going to come to terms with the big themes? And that's the lovely suspense that we find in memoir. And if you know, to give your reader that experience, you have to think a lot about how you're going to structure your book. You can, break things. You have the beginning of a story. With memoir, too, it's really interesting because memory isn't perfect. And so you can recreate the memory as you know, there's a snapshot in time. You look back. You may understand it. You may not. This is Mary Carr at the beginning of Liar's Club. You know, what did that mean? And then over time, she builds again to that scene, and you understand now over time all the characters and what that scene might have meant and what it might mean to you or me, you know, as readers. It's full of possibility. I love thinking about it and playing with it and reading it. I think every time you open a memoir, you should be surprised.
Yeah, that's interesting. And sometimes, though, it seems that the surprise in terms of writing it, if you know too much about what's happening when you write the first draft, maybe it flattens out a little bit. Maybe not, but I wonder what you think about that in terms of drafts, and if maybe the first draft is getting everything down, seeing what you have, the second draft is, I don't know, refining a bit, the third draft, you're on to something. I mean, how do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's true in anything we write, the drafting, but I think the first draft for memoir is figuring out what the questions are that you're really trying to answer, what your themes are. So, yeah, you know, you're writing things that happened, and you don't yet have a filter about what scene makes sense or what doesn't. But by the time you get to the end of that first draft, you should say to yourself, oh, my gosh, it wasn't about, it wasn't about despair. It was about hope. You know, I mean, just using but you know what I mean? And that's going to completely change the way you write your book, how you open your book, how you structure your book. So I think, and I find this with all of my students and with many people that I workshop with, I find that the first draft is more autobiographical. It's a telling what happened. Mm-hmm. It is flat because of that, because you already know what happened. You're not finding out. You're not in the process of finding out as you write. But then you look at it and you say, wow, I want to write a piece that delivers this kind of message. That's going to totally change. And then it becomes exciting. You don't know quite how you're going to achieve the result. You don't know if this scene might work. And it becomes urgent. It becomes more beautiful. It becomes more heart-pounding as you write. And the reader will experience that too.
I love that. Well, we're going to take a very short break, and when we return, we will have more Beth Kephart. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The Writers on Writing
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Byron
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday
at 9?
Wednesday
in the morning?
Wednesday.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're on iTunes at College Radio and at kuci.org, and you can listen on your phone. Very easy to go to the KUCI website, and there's a little corner thing you can click on. I think I click on MP3 or something, because I don't have real audio on my phone, and it comes right up. So experiment sometimes so that wherever you are, you can listen to the show if you like. Yet this show will hopefully join others. Sometimes we have a little trouble because tech problems do arrive, and we're all volunteers here, so we don't always have the time to put into getting everything just right. But hopefully this show will join the others that are up on the website at penonfire.com. And the archive of podcasts is at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And there's many, many shows that you can listen to, probably shows that Beth Kephart has been on in past years. We do have a fun drive coming up the end of October, beginning of November. And it's always a nice time to help out the station, help keep the lights on. So, like I said, we're all volunteers, and if you can help out, that's great. But you'll hear more of that if you listen at the end of the month. We'll be having our fun drive. The Pen on Fire speaker series is happening this coming week. Danny Shapiro, who is a memoirist and who has a new book out called Still Writing, will be with us. If you want to know more about that, go to penonfire.com and click on speaker series, and you will be delivered to a page where you can read more about the event and register if you like. Let's bring Beth Kephart back on the show. She is author of Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir. Hello there.
Hello. I love Danny. Danny and I are going to do an event here in Philadelphia together.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, why aren't you out here too?
I know. Wouldn't that be the best? We've talked. I mean, I've met her. We've talked also by phone, but this will be our first and only planned scheduled time.
Yeah, that's
time.
Great.
We're going to be at the, what is it called? It's the First Person Arts Festival in November. Yeah, we're going to sit for an hour and talk about the writing life.
Is it on your website or on your blog?
It is.
And
it
give is that address. Blog. Give the address.
Oh, my blog. Oh, yeah. Well, I think the easiest thing to do is just Google Beth Kephart Books, and you'll come right up to it.
Okay. And on Facebook?
I am on Facebook.
Okay. How do you like that?
How do I like Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, do you put, you know, because...
funny question.
Well, I mean, it's like we're...
I think it's an unexpected question. How do I like Facebook?
Well, I just mean in terms of, you know, agents and editors these days seem to be very encouraging of, you know, having your fan page and really doing promo and getting yourself out there and doing it through Facebook, Twitter.
I never think, you know what? I think about Facebook as primarily an opportunity. My blog is, most of the time, when I have the time, about other people's books and other people's lives. I write for the Philadelphia Choir once a month. This last week, for example, I wrote about the Pennsylvania Ballet. They're opening their 50th season. I got to go behind the scenes and watch the two principal dancers rehearse with Balanchine Trust repetitors. It was amazing. And so, in other words, I do photography, and my blog is about other things incredible people are doing, including writers. So, Facebook. I like to use Facebook as much as I can to share word about things that other people are doing. I'm not sure if my publishers were to look at my Facebook page, they'd think I was doing enough, you know, about like the typical fan page kind of thing. I don't even know how to set up, you know, that's not my nature too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's okay. and that's wonderful, the Balanchine, you know, coverage.
Amazing.
And you're a dancer.
I do ballroom dance at a late stage in my life, yes.
Yeah, that's great. And whenever I see a picture, whenever you post a picture, which I haven't seen one lately. I don't know if I've missed it or if...
No, I've been really busy. You know, as you know, I run a boutique marketing communications company, and we have been extraordinarily busy. I write books. My husband is a photographer and designer, and we create books for companies, books, annual reports, that sort of thing, employee magazines. So often, I just don't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to your book. Now, I found the chapter on, let me see what it was called. It was about you quoting and whether you use quotation marks around...
The dialogue? I hear voices?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I have really mixed feelings about that and whether, you know, you should reconstruct and put your quotes within quotation marks or not. And so I looked at just, you know, stacks of memoirs I have in my studio and noticed that most do, and most do put quotes within quotation marks. And it seems fine to me to do that. And I wonder if you could say more about that, about when to do it, when not to do it.
Oh, yes. And I'm not a rules person. I think that mostly in this book I'm trying to show readers their options and the possible reaction that they may get to such options, and I'm also trying to show how other writers have handled this. So in the case of dialogue, here's something that I think is very important. As I said before, Angela's Ashes, a book I loved, is not listed in the back of this because, of course, we hear so much from a 3, 4, 5 going forward year old's perspective, so much dialogue. I find it difficult when long passages of dialogue, especially from childhood scene, are quoted in any memoir. Long passages of dialogue, except if, as Buzz Bissinger did in Father's Day and others have done, a tape recorder has actually been brought out on the road during these conversations and you have the sense that you're actually listening to transcripted or reading transcripted conversation. Dialogue, however, does suggest the nature of a relationship and the quality of a person and how somebody speaks. And I think you can and should fairly use small bits of dialogue to characterize, as I said, you know, relationships and scenes and bring the whole memoir up to a quality of a novel. So long passages are not, I don't think, a good idea in memoir. In fact, I think it's a bad idea, long passages of quoted text. Even anything at 3, 4, 5, 6 years old is suspect. I just read a review, I wish I could remember, of some, it was within the last 2 days, of someone that said about a book, there's so much quoted dialogue that we are, of course, suspicious about the veracity of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's right there. Everybody feels the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you can use italics to, as Lise Funderburg does in Pig Candy. She This is a fantastic book about finding out who her father really was. And she's using italics, even though she did the research, she interviewed them, she has tapes, tape recorders, but it's suggestive that way. It's sort of a softer thing to do in memoir. There's many different ways to go about this.
What about dialogue that comes via email conversation?
That exists, and it's real, and you can use it if the other party is okay with that.
What if the other party is no longer around?
Ah, well, that's a tough one. I think you can use it. Letters, look, letters are important. Letters are a way, and I talk about that too in the book. I think it depends on what you're using it for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we cannot go about memoir with an attempt to have the last word.
Right.
So if you're using that bit of a letter or that bit of an email to prove your point that that person was just lousy, that may not be fair.
Right.
Five paragraphs later in that email that we the reader don't get to see, they may be saying, I know I'm going over the top with this. Let me pull back. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the full context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Let's talk a little bit about showing and telling, because, mm-hmm. you know, with novels, writers are always told, you know, show it, don't tell it, you got to show it. But
yep.
with memoir, there's a bit of telling that is more necessary than perhaps in novels. And it's a little difficult to grasp, I think, if you're a novelist going into the memoir realm.
Yeah. This is a great question, and I did, at your suggestion earlier today, pull one of my memoirs, Still Love in Strange Places, about being married to a Salvadoran man who's very different in this country than he is when he's at home speaking in his native tongue. I talked earlier about the importance of framing questions in memoirs, so the framing question of Still Love in Strange Places is, how well do we ever come to know the people we love? And this is a book about a land that, you know, full of earthquakes and volcanoes and civil war, and that's all throughout here. It all helps answer that question. But to show you what telling sounds like, it's necessary, especially in prologues and prefaces. I'm going to read a very short first chapter from the prologue where I'm telling you exactly what this book is about. Still Love in Strange Places is about romance and land. The book begins. Memory and imagination, exile and acceptance. Its setting is El Salvador, my husband's home. Its protagonist is a coffee farm high in the jungle hills. Its purpose is to explore the ways we arrive at what we love, the ways we surrender what we fear, the way stories rescue us from the strangeness of each other. So the book begins like that. But then, in a prologue, in the first proper chapter called Torn Photograph, Sepia Stained, and this is a little bit longer. This is suggestive, not directly reporting on what is to come. This is about a photograph.
Okay.
The tear runs like a river through a map, hurtling down toward his right shoulder, veering threateningly at his neck, then diverting south only to again pivot east at the fifth brass button of his captain's uniform. Below the tear, two more brass buttons in the clasp of his hands, and below all that, the military saber, the loosening creases on his pants, the shoes with their reflections of the snap of camera light. He is one of three in a sepia-colored portrait, and someone had to think to save his face. Someone had to put the photo back together, re-adhere the northeast quadrant of this map with three trapezoids of tape so that his left hand would fall again from his left elbow and he would still belong to us. We suppose he is the best man at a wedding. We suppose that it was 80 years ago before the Matanza, before he was jailed and then set free, before he saved the money to buy the land that became St. Anthony's Farm. Did I ever tell you what my grandfather did the year the farm first turned a profit? No. And then it goes on, it's my husband starting then to tell me a story of this grandfather who's so pivotal to him. So here in this paragraph, I am not just reporting on a photograph. I am suggesting the nature of the process of the book that will follow. I am piecing things together. I am also someone who has to think to save this family. I am also someone who has to suppose. And it will be my husband's stories that inform this book. So this is suggestive of process, as while also describing something, whereas prologue, that first chapter I read, it is telling you what the book is going to be about.
Interesting. You know, I'm glad you talked about photographs, or you read that little piece, because I remember that memoir of yours with photographs, and wonder if you could talk a little bit about using photographs in memoir, and when to do it, when not to do it, whether to do it, whether to even try to do it, because, you know, and I'm just talking really black and white. I know color's expensive to reproduce,
I actually wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal blog Speakeasy, and all of, if you go to my website, there's a Handling the Truth tab, and I've written about 15 essays beyond Handling the Truth about issues that, you know, didn't fit into the book or are newly considered, and one of this, and I love the question, is about photography and its uses. I love talking about Dorothy Allison, for example, because she, in one of her memoirs, talks about, you know, all the things that she's getting wrong, and yet it is peppered with these black and white photographs, or all the places where she feels she can exaggerate, I guess. All of these photographs, and you're looking at the photographs, and you're looking at her words about these people, and you see this direct correlation. And so it adds this really interesting level of reader participation. You know, how much is she really exaggerating? Why is she telling us that she's, you know, that book is two or three things I forgot to tell you. Michael Ondaatje in Running the Family uses some small images, some moments. Patti Smith has them, of course. So many do. And I think it's very, I love it, but it has to be organic.
Mm-hmm.
It has to come out of not a desire to document or to prove, but a sense of, you know, a layering. It is another way of telling a story. It is another way to break the structure. There's a correspondence between the poetry and the face that you're looking at. It deepens the experience. It should not be a journalistic use. Like, here is my farm. I said there was a farm. Here's the farm. It's not like that.
Yeah. No, that's a great explanation. We have a few minutes left with Beth Kephart. Her book is Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir, published by Gotham. So did you write all of your memoirs before you tried to sell them? Or did you ever do proposals for them and just, you know, do all the proposal stuff and include a few chapters? Or how did you do it, and what would you suggest?
Let me think about all of them. Well, let's see. I would suggest getting, this is not consistent for, let me think about it. I think that I've written at least two-thirds of the books before I tried to sell them. In some cases, though, there were two book situations, so the editor already had a sense for what the next book would be about. However, those were just two-thirds in of a first draft. And also, however, I'm now, you know, working on my 18th book. I've published all kinds of other things. I really believe, this is one lesson I've learned in finishing your book before you try to sell it, because, first of all, editors appreciate that more. Secondly, you will get a bigger, this doesn't really apply to me because I do small literary books, but you will normally get a bigger advance if it's a finished book. But also, you want to be able to know what it is you're selling. And with memoir, if you're saying as a proposal, it's about my life and I climbed a mountain and this happened, you're not in any way giving them a sense for the nature of the themes, the questions, the urgency, the beauty of what it could be. You're simply flatlining the autobiographical at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about length, too? Because I think the length of your books is just right. And some memoirs are so big, and you just go, you know, how arrogant that the author wrote that much.
All that time of mine. No, I know exactly what you mean.
Well, you have so much to read, you know.
My favorite female novelist is Alice McDermott, And she writes the perfect length book. And it takes her 7 years, each one sometimes. But because each line is perfect and you know each line was considered, I am biased toward the shorter books, fiction or nonfiction, because I believe I've written novels that at first draft are 500 and final book is 165. It's an intensifying, it's a clarifying. Mm-hmm. As you know, and if you are just writing endless pages and they go on, have you really given your all to every single sentence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you said, you know, shorter can mean more intensity, more clarification, just that the pages have been worked over and and really, you know, you threw out what you really didn't need.
Still Love in Strange Places, the book I read from, 15 years in the making, could have been a novel, was at one point, could have been a screenplay, that was close. This book went through so many iterations, and so often do my novels.
Hmm.
And then it's short.
And yeah, short. It's, you know, it's perfect size. Talk a little bit about telling detail. You have a chapter on that in the book, which I think is so important, no matter what you're writing.
I celebrate in that chapter Natalie Kutz, as I spoke of her earlier. I love her telling detail I hope that any listeners will just, if they don't buy the book, open it to that chapter and read Natalie Kutz, because she really masters the telling detail in a scene that I quote in this book. I believe that memoirists have the responsibility to filter out the huge number of details that make a life and identify the signifiers. And that's what a telling detail does in memoir. It's the signifier. It is that sort of metaphorical thing that has been seen or heard or experienced that speaks to the question the memoirist is trying to answer and is remembered and memorable. You know, you say to somebody after you've read the book, you don't tell, you know, you're not inclined to tell this is what happened to this person. You're inclined to say, Natalie Kutz, when she was gravely injured by these dogs when she was a little girl, tossed her second mitten to the sky because she felt sorry for it. That's the telling detail in Natalie Kutz's Road Song that blows me away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. That is really nice. I just marked that chapter to read again in your book. We are drawing down on our time, and I wonder just a few words about voice, because you have a very strong voice. I wonder if it's always been, if that's something poetry gave you, and what you could say about voice.
I think it's hugely important. It is not the same for every book. It is rhyme and rhythm. I begin each new book, each new work by taking walks, sometimes by dancing. I don't write until I hear the rhythm of the words first, and then I hear a sound, a gush or a precision or something harsh or something soft that I want to somehow tell my story with, and then language comes in.
Hmm.
And I don't know, how much time do we have?
We have a couple, we have maybe 2 minutes.
Okay, so I'm going to read the last 2 minutes. This book that I told you about, Flo, about the Schuylkill River and her voice, this is the first little bit. This is voice. When you asked me earlier today, Barbara, about voice, this for me is voice.
Okay.
She sounds like this, my river. From within the fissure I rise, old as anything. The gravel beneath me slides, blueback airing an eel, alewife and shad muscle into my wide blue heart and through. The smudged face of a wolf pools on my surface, and for that one instant I go blind. And then just a little more. Hemlock to either side, nut trees, laurel copses, the stony backs of snapping turtles on the shore, muskrat shrew, and from the unlanterned forest, the bark of a fox, the skith, skith, skith of snakes over leaves, the prowl of a bobcat, and when it rains, the rain is its own kind of song, not just a drumming but a lyric. Were there language, I'd be my own lone letter.
That's so nice. That's lovely.
That's how I feel about voice.
Like, mm-hmm.
If there were language, what letter would you be? Mm-hmm. Start over. Recreate it. Make it yours.
That's nice. In closing, wonder if you can, you know, offer any words on getting out of your own way or dealing with, I don't know, dealing with blocks or when you're in a corner and how to write your way out of it.
Oh, boy, I'm in so many corners all the time with writing. The thing that you have to do is somehow shatter what is there before you and think about it in a new way. It doesn't help if after the third or fourth or fifth cycle through a passage, it's just staying static, and you think, if only I fix this word or only that sentence, it'll work. Probably not. If it is not working after many, many passes, if you are so frustrated, shatter it, get rid of it, vanquish it, and start over from a new perspective.
Mm.
Don't get caught in the rut of endless revision on something that will never work. It happens to me all the time. I look back and I think, why did I waste all that time on that? I needed to start over.
Mm-hmm. And you can start over on the same basic project.
Oh, 100%. I'm talking about saying, Small Damages, one of my novels, 10 years, 85 drafts. I'm working on another book now. Boy, was it bad, the first three drafts. Then I thought, aha, I need this. It's the same book,
mm-hmm.
but it sounds different now.
Interesting. Lovely to talk with you, as always.
Thank you.
Love your book. And thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you so much.
It was Beth Kephart. Her book is Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir. And I do love this book. I honestly do love this book. And, you know, a lot of writing books, and I like most of them. But I love this one. And anyway, that's all we have today. We have to go. If you want to know more about the show or the Pen on Fire speaker series, visit penonfire.com. Until next time. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. And there is one more event in Laguna Beach on Monday at the Laguna Playhouse. I'll be moderating a panel of authors. You can go to the Laguna Beach Playhouse website and click on special events, and you should see it. It should be a wonderful, wonderful night. That's it. Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you soon.